It seems like only yesterday that I delivered my first sermon from this pulpit. I remember it well. I started by mentioning the crisp coolness that was sneaking into the air and how the days were getting shorter. And now, as it always happens with the continual cycle that is life, the trees and flowers are in full bloom, the air is warm, and we are graced with extra hours of sunshine for work, play, gardening, sports, and simply doing nothing. On that August morning, I was delivering my first sermon to you as the latest in a long line of intern ministers who've had the privilege of learning in this congregation. I wondered aloud, will they like me? Will I like them? Will I fit in? All reasonable questions. Would we create real connections, wide, rich, deep, succulent relationships where we would each feel seen, heard, and valued? Would we give and receive without judgment? Would we build relationships from which we would both derive sustenance and strength? Would we be present, honest, vulnerable, and generous with each other? Would we learn to trust each other? That was 10 months ago. And looking at it from this side of the pulpit, I'd say this has been an amazing year. We've been through a lot together. And I'm going to recap a few of those things. We've celebrated holidays, special days, and sometimes just the joy of being together on a Tuesday. In large groups and one-on-one, we ate and drank, sang and danced, laughed and joked together. We've been there for one another in times of sadness and distress. I've visited you in hospitals and in your homes. We've sat in probably every room of this church, in coffee shops, in Skype conferences. We've emailed and we've spent hours on the phone. We've cared for one another. You comforted me through my little cousin Logan's cancer treatments. He is in rehab and doing better. And you brought me soup when I had a vicious upper respiratory infection this winter. We've worshiped together through song, prayer, meditation, and reflection. We've tackled issues of theological significance such as gratitude, fear, resurrection, and blessing. Together, we faced the aftermath of the November presidential election and the fear, confusion, anger, and disappointment that followed. Together, we have continued to persist and resist. We've also addressed the issue of race in our denomination and our community. In October, we did a lot of work around our Black Lives Matter panel and the feelings that it generated. In February, I shared with you what it's like for me to be a Black UU and my concerns for my future ministry. Little did I know that February day that less than 30 days later, the white centeredness that has been at the core of our faith for hundreds of years, that white centeredness that we all took for granted, would erupt with such magnitude and force and passion and in such a way that I know in my heart has changed us all forever. We joined 700 congregations nationwide and internationally in the teach-in. And in that process, some of you opened doors in your hearts and minds and souls that had previously been closed. Some of you found doors and windows that you never even knew existed. Some of you opened those doors and windows wide and let the light rush in, eagerly soaking up new ideas and perspectives. You opened your heart to Maria McCabe and to me and to the other people of color in this congregation and listened as we shared with you how we felt, and you expressed a willingness to learn more. Some of you opened those doors and windows tentatively, just a crack. And some of you didn't open those doors at all for reasons that only you know deep down in your heart. And because of those reasons, you're not able or not willing or simply not ready to tackle the issue and have those difficult conversations. And that's okay. Or maybe, like our president and his reaction to global warming, you don't even believe there is a door that needs to be opened. Some of you are willing to have the conversation, if we can call it something other than white supremacy. When talking about the issue with his congregation, Reverend Powellek of the Unitarian Universalist Society in Manchester, Connecticut, said this: "Wait, what? White supremacy? In Unitarian Universalism? How can white supremacy apply to our justice-seeking, Black Lives Matter-supporting, refugee-resettling, criminal justice-reforming, GLBTQ-welcoming, earth-saving, answering the call of love liberal faith? There must be some mistake. White supremacy applies to those other white people. To the alt-right, the people who want border walls and Muslim bans, who desecrate Jewish cemeteries, who commit hate crimes." He was being facetious, but quickly got to the heart of the matter when he reminded them that our Unitarian and Universalist denominations were founded by white people to serve the spiritual needs of white people in the decades following the founding of the United States, which was, by law, a country for white people. People of color were present among our spiritual forebears, but they were highly marginalized, in part because they had a less than human legal status in the larger society. White identity, values, culture, spirituality, music, food, and concerns, he wrote, were at the center of early Unitarian and Universalist institutional life. That's the white supremacy we're talking about, that unexplained assumption that the center is always white. Today, much has changed about our faith and much has changed about America. But if our institutions have never made a serious commitment to decentering whiteness, then it is always possible for white supremacy to operate. Even in the midst of our support for Black Lives Matter, refugee resettlement, former inmates, domestic workers, and undocumented people, all of it essential work expressing our commitment to confronting racism, we can still perpetuate white supremacy. So he said. I've received lots of feedback about the use of that term. Some good, some bad. There's more than a little bit of discomfort about it. And to be honest, I've been concerned about how my engagement in the issue, my opening the doors to the teach-in, will affect the relationships I have with some of you. And my future ministerial prospects. When I use the term white supremacy, it's not to accuse anyone or to attack anyone. It just is what it is. And sometimes that makes us uncomfortable, but it doesn't change the truth. Reverend Powellek says, when my people of color, indigenous people, and white anti-racist colleagues, people who I know and love and have worked with for many years, use the term white supremacy to describe Unitarian Universalism, I've learned to listen. I've learned to open my heart, approach the conversation with curiosity, and try to understand why the term makes sense. I've learned people don't use this term merely to be provocative. They don't use it to be mean. They don't use it to make white people feel guilty. They use it to make sense of their own painful experiences within Unitarian Universalism. They use it to help themselves and others understand why decent, compassionate, loving, justice-seeking white people can nevertheless do and say things that are hurtful, often with no awareness. They use it to help themselves and others understand why spiritually open, love-centered, justice-seeking institutions can fail to practice stated commitments to diversity, multiculturalism, and anti-racism. In using this term, no one is calling anyone else a white supremacist. No one is likening the UUA or our congregations to the KKK or the alt-right. But they are pointing out how our institutions center white people, white identity, experience, culture, ministers, history, and spirituality, and how it makes them feel excluded, less than, and invisible. And I would add to his words, wary, frustrated, and hurt. But this isn't going to be another sermon on race. But it is about being open to the possibility that perhaps we are not perfect, that perhaps we aren't fully living into our principles, that perhaps change is needed, not out there, although Lord knows from the multitude of things that I've seen in the news, change is needed out there. But perhaps we can be open to the possibility that change is needed in here, within our walls. Reverend Kent became my teaching pastor back in the fall of 2015, a full year before you ever saw me here. During that first year, we met monthly and shared our thoughts on ministry in general, on our denomination, our society, and how we integrated those things in our personal lives. We spoke at length about anti-racism and anti-oppression efforts and ways to promote multiculturalism and diversity at USG and within the larger church. For this past year, my ministerial portfolio, as he calls it, included social justice, caring, and worship, meaning those would be my three main areas of focus. Along with that, we added an examination of USG's multiculturalism and diversity efforts. Kent and I took a class together at Meadville this past fall entitled Unleashing Your Multicultural Ministry that focused on ways to make our congregation more inclusive, more diverse, more welcoming, not just to people of color, but to people with different gender identities, sexual orientation, physical abilities, economic and educational backgrounds, etc. For those of you who've been at USG for a while, some of this might sound familiar. My task is the resurrection of the USG transformation team. Over my remaining time here at USG, I'll be researching, observing, and meeting with staff, ministry teams, committees, and individuals to see where we are truly inclusive and welcoming and where we're falling short. I'll prepare a report that'll be presented to Kent and probably to the ministry executive team and the board, and possibly shared with the entire congregation. Even though this assignment was made prior to the events of the last 90 days, there's no doubt in my mind that the timing for it is perfect. Clearly, the very fact that so much stuff has been stirred up since the teach-in is proof that we still have some work to do. But that's not all I'll be doing next year. I'll continue to work with caring, worship, and social justice, and will once again chair our Martin Luther King Day of Service in January. I'll also be branching out into interfaith community engagement. You may know that Kent sits on the Religious Leaders Council of the Interfaith Center of Greater Philadelphia. He and I both recognize the need to know and to work with our neighbors of other faith traditions, especially here in our own physical community. We might not agree on the existence of God or other theological points, but I dare say we are all dedicated to maintaining a clean, healthy, and safe living environment for our families. As Lambeth University Professor Jean Davenport says, differences of belief do not mean that we can't work together for common social goals. I say it only makes sense that we should work together. If nothing else, the political events of the last few months have taught us that those of us who believe in peace, justice, equality, and protecting the environment have to stick together. We have to. So in what's called my focused initiative, I'll be working on a project that I've named Interfaith Connection and Action. The purpose of the program is to bring together neighbors from various houses of worship, churches, synagogues, mosques, etc., to complete a community project right here in West Mount Airy. It's a combination of education, fellowship, and service, and will take place over the next church year. Here's how it'll work. Before he went on sabbatical, Kent and I created a list of 12 to 15 houses of worship that we wanted to invite to a potluck here at USG that'll happen in probably August or September. During that meal, we'll decide on some community project that needs to happen in our area. It might be a food drive, cleaning up a park, or fixing up a school library. A team from the participating houses of worship will plan and execute the project. Our monthly planning meetings will be potlucks as well, and will rotate in location among the other participating houses of worship. The church or congregation that hosts for that month will also invite the group to attend one of their worship services and host an educational session afterward about their faith tradition. After the service project has been completed, we'll celebrate with a final meal back here at USG. I'm really excited about this project. My professors at Meadville have approved it, as have my intern committee and the ministry executive team here. Betsy Gabriel and Elaine Hills have already been a huge help, and I hope that more of you will join me in this work as well. So here we are, halfway through my internship. I knew I would learn a lot, but I never imagined I would love this work as much as I do. Any questions or doubts that I had about my call to ministry are long gone. I know I'm on the right path for me. My last official act of the church year will be on the 18th, when I have the honor of dedicating Catherine and Justin King's children. And then I'm off for the summer. I'll be back on August 14th, right before Kent returns. So while I'm here and I have the microphone and you can't go anywhere, I'd like to publicly thank Mark and Jason and Gloria, Carolyn, Mike, and Tito for being fantastic colleagues. My internship committee, Tom Ott, Debbie Ward, Parvati Menon, Fran Emery, and Charles Gabriel, thank you for your guidance and support. To the choir, the caring ministry, the worship arts and social justice teams, and the many dedicated volunteers who keep this place humming along, to David, and yes, even Bob. Thank you. Even Bob, thank you, and I love you. I hope that you've enjoyed this year as much as I have. It's been wonderful, and I'm looking forward to being back here again next year.